Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
Joined now by Albert Breer of Sports Illustrated. He's been doing a good job covering all of the drama of the NFL. And I want to start here because I just opened the show talking about it, Albert. How many teams do you think more would have bid on Brady if they knew what he was going to look like on the field this year? I don't mean if he knew he was going to win the Super Bowl, obviously. But I mean just throwing 40 touchdown passes, continuing to get better and better as the season went along. How many teams, because it didn't seem like Brady had a massive market. I think we talked about the Bucs and maybe the Chargers being somewhat interested in him, maybe the Titans a little bit. But how many more teams would have bid on Brady if they knew he was capable of throwing 40 or 50 touchdowns and would look like he did?
Yeah, I think Clay, his market would obviously be complicated by his age. And so there are certain teams where it should be a non-starter based on the fact that maybe they aren't ready to win at that level yet. But I think there are a couple that you can point to and say maybe they would have been better off. The Niners are one. Now, Jimmy got hurt, but I think based on his history, you could have forecast that there was injury risk with Jimmy to begin with. So there's one, and he wanted to go to San Francisco. The Titans, I think it's a fair question, although Ryan Tannehill has played at a pretty high level there. The Colts, I think you can certainly say maybe they would have been better off with Brady over Rivers based on where their roster is. And the one sort of like curveball one to me that makes sense would be New Orleans. And I just look at the composition of that roster and the issues that they're going to have now going forward with the salary cap, some of their free agents. They were really in a sweet spot this year where they were, I think, at a championship level at so many different positions. And so the Saints would be the one where you look at them and say, you understand why they couldn't walk away from Drew Brees, but you look at the situation they were in and the sort of year that Brees had, the ups and downs and everything else. And I think you can certainly say, like, the Saints, maybe they would have been the Bucs if Tom Brady had been their quarterback.
It's interesting as you kind of break this down in a larger context. Much of the drama in the offseason is almost exclusively going to be centered around the quarterback position. I saw a lot of the mock drafts. I think Todd McShay's mock draft went up yesterday or day before, whatever it was. And I think he had five quarterbacks going in the top 12, which is pretty crazy, including the first four all being quarterbacks. Of the quarterbacks that are out there, how many guys do you think are actually available in this mix right now? Okay, these are the guys that have created the most drama of late. Russell Wilson, Dak Prescott, Carson Wentz, Deshaun Watson. It seems to me that Carson Wentz is the only one on that list that maybe is 100% available for the taking. Would you expect that Russell Wilson, Dak Prescott, or Deshaun Watson are available at all? Are teams even willing to listen to offers for them?
No, I mean, I think right now Carson Wentz is the only one who's available, and he's very available because the Eagles shot for the moon and asking for the Matthew Stafford return. I don't even know if they're going to be able to get a one back, which was sort of supposed to be their baseline. But by making this negotiable, by making it public, I think they've sort of reached the point of no return with Carson Wentz. So I think he'll be dealt, just a matter of where and for what. With the other three guys, I mean, look, like Dak's medical kind of complicates things a little bit. I do believe that they're going to wind up tagging him, and he's going to be their quarterback in 2021. The contract negotiation, I think, is going to be interesting because there's so much water under the bridge there. And then I think with Deshaun and with Russell Wilson, both teams fully intend to hold on to the guys. These are different things, though. I mean, Deshaun Watson's put up with a lot. And he's been a good soldier through a lot in Houston. And I think he's sort of at the point where he's fed up. And where this goes, I think, is going to be interesting just because Houston hasn't even entertained trade offers. Teams have called and they've said he's just not available. And, you know, at the same time, when they've tried to get in touch with Deshaun, he's not returning their calls. So it's hard to say where that one's going to go, but it's kind of built to this. Whereas with Russell Wilson, some of the stuff you're hearing now, I think has sort of been, I would say, like years long, like low level displeasure with certain things that in that organization. And I feels to me a little like Russell seized upon some of the things that we've seen happen with Aaron Rodgers and with Matthew Stafford over the last few weeks.
So this is, I want to go to the Russell Wilson situation. It seems to me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that Pete Carroll has been in Russell Wilson's corner about as aggressively as a head coach can be in the corner, even to the extent that when there seemed to be an offense versus defense battle that was emerging, he shipped and moved on from Richard Sherman, from Michael Bennett, from all those guys that were a big part of the defense. The Legion of Boom, I think, was their nickname back when they beat the Denver Broncos, and said, no. When Russell Wilson threw that interception, Russell Wilson is the future of this franchise. We're going to move on from anybody who doesn't believe that. And there may have been some apprehension or disagreement on that defensive side of the ball. It surprised me that Russell Wilson was willing to say anything negative like he did publicly. Did it surprise you? Would you agree with that characterization about Pete Carroll being in Russell Wilson's camp?
I'd agree with you, like, that he has defended Russell Wilson and he's been in Russell Wilson's corner to the point where, you know, like, Pete's been pretty, I guess, consistent about the way he wants his teams built and the way he wants his offense run. And he veered from that last year to try to accommodate Russell Wilson. So he's made accommodations for him, you know, over time. I think as much as anything else, again, I just feel like this is sort of Russell seizing on something that he's seeing happen in other places across the league. His complaint about getting hit too much, like, is not new. Like, that goes back to before they even dealt for Dwayne Brown to be their left tackle a few years ago. And, you know, so I sort of think that this is like a continuation of what we saw with Aaron Rodgers, where I don't necessarily think that it's, I want to get out of town. It's, I see that now I've got an avenue to put pressure on my front office to go and get me help. And I think what those guys are looking at, they look at Buffalo going and getting Stephon Diggs for Josh Allen. They look at how aggressive the Chiefs have been in putting weapons around Patrick Mahomes. They look at what Tampa's done. I mean, the most incredible stat from the Super Bowl, Clay, I thought, all four of the touchdowns were scored by guys who were acquired after Tom Brady, who went to Tampa to be with Tom Brady. It was Fournette, it was Gronkowski scoring twice, and then it was Antonio Brown. And so I think as much as anything else, what we've seen from Wilson is a little bit more like what we've seen from Rodgers, which is, I don't necessarily want out right now, but I'm not afraid anymore to put pressure on you to go find me help and be aggressive in doing it, because I see other teams doing that for their quarterbacks.
It's interesting. You don't think Deshaun Watson's going to move on. Carson Wentz is available. Russell Wilson, maybe a little bit of drama, but it's hard to see anything happening there. What are the Cowboys going to do with Dak? What are you hearing about that? We talked about earlier in the week, Dak follows the Washington football team on his social media, I guess his Instagram account, for a short period of time. Cowboys leave him out of the hype video, which, I mean, is pretty crazy in and of itself. What is the story with the Cowboys and Dak, and how does this situation resolve itself? And also, what are you hearing about his health?
Yeah, I mean, I think the health is worth monitoring. Obviously, the fact that he had a second surgery isn't a great development, no matter how you slice it. And we've seen that before with guys having, you know, certain complications with their surgery. So the fact that he had a second surgery isn't great news. You know, and I think if you're the team, it might push you into a spot where you say, maybe we're better off just tagging him and
again,
waiting and seeing for another year, which I think they will tag him. The problem with that, Clay, is what's on the other side of this. His franchise tag number for 2022 would be over $52 million, which is just, I mean, that's like a quarter of your salary cap. You know what I mean? Like, so I think at that point it's, you know, Dak can look at it and say, well, all right, tag me again. I'll collect my $40 million. You either give me a deal I'm happy with, or I've got $52 million or free agency coming to me in 2022. So one way or the other, I'm either going to have $92 million over the next 2 years, or I'm going to wind up being a free agent at 28 years old. So, you know, I think that's why it's difficult to get Dak to agree to a long-term deal, because really his options are, again, either one, $90 million over the next 2 years, two, close to $40 million in free agency next year, or three, I do a long-term deal. So your long-term deal is going to have to beat out those other two options. which looked pretty good.
So it is interesting the Cowboys have found themselves in this spot. Now, you will know the answer better than me. Kirk Cousins is the guy that I remember getting double franchised, and then he became a free agent. Is there no prohibition on how many times in a row you can franchise tag a player now in the NFL?
It's three times in a row. And so the way it works is the first tag is whatever the assigned number is for your position, or 120% of what you made the year before. And then, you know, whatever your figure is in that year, the next year is 120% of that, which is where we're at right now, which is going to be about almost $38 million for Dak this year. And then the third tag, which is the final tag, you can't tag a guy past that, is 144% of that number. So that's how you get to over $52 million in 2022. And yeah, three tags and that's it. After that, you can't tag a guy anymore. So right now, Dak is looking at, like, you either, I mean, if we don't do a deal, you either tag me at over $50 million and then I become a free agent at 29, or I become a free agent at 28.
So that is a good position to be in then if you're Dak, right?
Yeah. Because
you're,
I mean, that was a Kirk Cousins position, yeah.
Yeah. Unless you get another season-ending injury, right? That's the thing that's kind of hanging out there. But even if that were to happen, you would still have locked in whatever it is, $75 million basically, right, for 2 years. And then you'd be able to go back to the free agent market.
It'd be more than that, Clay, because it's about 38 plus 52. So we're talking about like right around $90 million for the next 2 years.
Right, right. We're talking about last year he got.
Oh, yeah. Last year plus this year. Yep. And then
that's still not a bad spot to be in, right? I mean, even worst case scenario, unless he had like an Alex Smith level injury or he couldn't come back and play and he looked like a totally different player, he's still going to make an absolute bevy of money.
And consider this, too. I mean, I think, like, the injury thing, it definitely applies at other positions, but doesn't it apply a little less at the quarterback position? I mean, consider this. Tua Tagovailoa suffered a, like, god-awful injury, right? Like a car accident injury, and still went fifth overall in the draft. If that happens to somebody in another position, there is no way the guy, like, goes even in the first round, no matter how good he is.
Right.
And because Tua is a quarterback, he survived that. We've seen other teams take chances on quarterbacks who are hurt. Dante Culpepper all those years ago coming off the injury he was coming off of. Drew Brees couldn't throw. Like Peyton Manning, you know, the neck injuries. I mean, like, yeah, there's injury risk, but, you look at the history of it, and, like, quarterbacks are almost immune to even that. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, the injury risk is there, yes, but for someone like Dak, like, you play that position – and even the injury risk isn't what it is at other positions. So, Dak's in a really good spot. Of course, like, there's the whole human aspect of this, which is when you go through something like what Dak's gone through over the last 4 months, like, that's, there's going to be maybe a feeling like maybe I should just take my money now. But, yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of it, there's no question. Like, quarterbacks are immune to those sorts of things to some extent. And that's, I mean, that was proven out last April with where Tua went in the draft after his injury.
Yeah, it's a good point about the difference in the overall quarterback marketplace in general. When you look at, I think I kind of hinted at the idea that five guys might go in the top 12 of the NFL draft, five quarterbacks, that is. How are teams going to make a decision? Like, let's talk about a couple that are out there that are clearly in the market. If you are the Patriots or you are the Bears or you are the Colts, for instance, three teams that I think it's fair to say need quarterbacks. How do you assess potentially being able to make a move in the free agent market, whether it's go aggressively after Carson Wentz, maybe kick the tires on some of these guys, Jameis Winston, Teddy Bridgewater? There's going to be moving parts, right, associated with not only the draft. How do you decide between young guy versus reclamation project, between going and trying to find your version of Ryan Tannehill as opposed to going into the draft and just saying, hey, let's start anew?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of comes down to, like, what you're willing to invest in. And the fact is, if you take, like, a chance, and say, like, a Marcus Mariota, who's available right now, right? There's a chance it doesn't work. Like, there's a chance you go through the same injury issue that Tennessee went through for all those years. But the upside is that you don't really have to commit to him long-term. So if it doesn't work out, well, then, like, you can try again next year. You can try again the year after that versus – like, if you make a massive move up, and if you're New England or Indianapolis or Washington, one of these teams that would have to move up to get one of the top four, Well, then if you're doing that, then you're talking about, all right, this is our quarterback for the next 5 years. We're not looking for one after this. We can't hit the reset button really after that. We're making a massive investment. And so, you know, I think really, you know, when you consider one versus the other, it's, are we kind of stopgapping the position and just buying ourselves time to find a long-term answer? Or do we think there's a long-term answer out there for us? And that to me is kind of, you know, the difference if you're looking at, again, like a Mariota or bringing in a Bridgewater versus going and selling out to maybe trade up for a Justin Fields or a Zach Wilson or a Trey Lance. And, you know, there are a ton of teams that have used the whole buying time idea in the past to great effect. I think that's what Alex Smith was in Kansas City. Like the Chiefs didn't have to force it for 4 years because they had perfectly competent quarterback play, and that bought them time to go and find Patrick Mahomes, you know? So we've seen examples of this in the past, and I do think that that's sort of, you know, what some of these teams are looking at right now, where it's, you know, do I want to find a guy who can be good enough and can buy me time to find a superstar down the line, or do I believe one of the rookies are worth selling out for to go up and get and be my superstar for the next 10, 15 years?
So what does that mean the Colts do in particular, right? They tried to go find the bridge gap with Phillip Rivers, and Phillip Rivers is retiring. Jacoby Brissett's a free agent. Doesn't seem likely they're going to commit to him. The Andrew Luck rumors were out there. It doesn't seem like Andrew Luck is going to come back. What do you think they're thinking right now? Is it Carson Wentz or bust?
They're kicking tires on Carson Wentz, but I don't know that they're willing. I mean, I can tell you this. They didn't offer a first-round pick for Matthew Stafford. So they were in the Stafford sweepstakes, but they weren't going to go anywhere close to where the Panthers or Washington or certainly the Rams went on Stafford. So I think they're certainly in a similar sort of mode with Carson Wentz, where it's, we're willing to go there, we're willing to bring him in, but we'd more like to take a flyer on him than we want to truly invest in him. And I think that's where Chicago sort of is right now, too. So could the Eagles get a first-round pick for him? Maybe, but I think it would be in a more complicated deal with some other stuff going the other way. So I think that's where the Colts are right now on Carson Wentz. And I think they're very much looking at the idea of trading up. And I think it's a interesting detail, at least, Clay, that Chris Ballard, the GM there, was in Kansas City for the process of scouting Mahomes, was in Kansas City for the 4 years that Alex Smith was the quarterback there as they built the roster up for whoever the long-term quarterback was going to be. And he was one of the guys that kind of, you know, signed off on saying, this is Patrick Mahomes can be the guy here. And so, you know, you sort of wonder, maybe he has somebody in mind this year where they built the roster up. And because of that, maybe they look at some of their draft capital as a little more disposable, where they could make a massive move up for a quarterback. So it wouldn't surprise me if we get to April, and if Carson Wentz weren't to wind up there, if the Colts are a team we're talking about making a massive move up the board for a Fields, a Wilson, or a Lance.
Last question for you. How much interest is there in Marcus Mariota?
I think it's tepid interest right now. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he was the guy that New England wound up going with, to be honest with you. I think right now the question is, and you watched him for a long time in Nashville, Clay, you have to play him a certain way to win with him, and the question is, can he stay healthy if you're playing that way?
Right. I think that's fair. Albert Breer, good stuff as always. I appreciate it, my man. We'll talk to you again soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Clay.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
I don't know when I'm going to get used to what day it is. I got to be more careful saying what day it is. This is the Farmers Outkick Studios. You can call Farmers today for a quote. So many of the days I got all rattled because we did this show from March 11th to whatever it was, July, and every day was like Groundhog Day. You know, you just woke up and it was like it didn't really matter what day it was, didn't really matter what month it was. And then the NFL season happened and we were playing games on so many different days of the week. Right. And so a lot of times for me, at least in the fall, the NFL is often kind of a rough arbiter of the schedule. Oh, we've got a Monday night football game. Oh, we've got a Thursday night football game. So I'm thinking about the week in the context of when games are going to happen and everything else. And now football is over, but we still played Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday games. And now football is over. And it still feels a bit out of sorts in terms of what's normal. Like my kids were out of school for a snow day. And my kids are back in person physically for school. But I thought, you know, they'll probably just do remote days. They don't do that for snow days. And by the way, there was no snow by us. It was a fear of ice. And so, you know, we woke up on Thursday and school ends up getting canceled. And so that threw the whole Thursday day out of whack. Felt like Friday. Then we got the holiday coming up on Monday. Anyway, everything is out of sorts. You know who's not out of sorts? I saw this story and I thought to myself, this is absolutely fantastic. So we put this up on OutKick yesterday, but the moment that I saw it on Thursday morning, it was pretty phenomenal. So there's a woman named Phyllis Pena from Texas, and there is a story about an alleged peeping Tom that was looking in, she says, her 15-year-old daughter's window. And Phyllis just absolutely laid the hammer down on this guy. Our tease on it yesterday on OutKick. I mean, I don't know how you don't click on this, but when I saw it go up, because I saw this video and I sent it to our editors, and I was like, this is going to be absolutely phenomenal. People are going to love this story. But our crew put up the headline, and it's a pretty fantastic one that I saw and I shared it. Like, just all in all phenomenal that basically the let me read it to you exactly, because you saw this too, Dub, and you were like, this is absolutely amazing. And I agree. The Chiefs could have used Texas mom Phyllis Pena during the Super Bowl. Watch Phyllis drop the hammer on a peeping Tom as he tries to hit the open field. All right. So that's the tease. Let me go ahead and play. This is a local news story out of Texas. Let me go ahead and let you listen to the audio. And again, I'd encourage you to go to outkick.com and look at the video of Phyllis. I definitely think she was making big time plays on the field. So listen to this, and then we'll unpack the play when we come back.
A police officer's dash cam rolling when a Houston area mother tackles a suspected peeper who she says was looking into her daughter's bedroom. KPRC2's Michael Lepardi live at Lake Jackson PD tonight and just spoke with the mom. Michael?
Dominique, that mom had just returned home from the store around 7 o'clock in the morning when she saw a man in her yard. She says he was able to get away from two officers, but not from her.
Even if you think you can run from the cops, good luck getting past this mom.
I figured at least I could do if I got them down, tripped them up, whatever, then they'd, you know, have a chance to get caught up.
That's Phyllis Pena in the red shirt.
First instinct was just to make sure he didn't go any further.
Captured on police dash cam, taking down a man she says was trying to look into her 15-year-old daughter's bedroom window early on a Sunday morning.
My kids are my life and, you know, just making sure I protect them, pretty much.
Lake Jackson Police Sergeant Rory Welch gave her some credit.
It was a pretty good tackle.
He told us the suspect is 19-year-old Zane Hawkins. Police found Hawkins nearby, but he tried to get away. They say he started running back towards mom, who moved in and made the tackle. Her daughter helped hold down the suspect until officers caught up.
Not very often that we have somebody that actually steps in and puts themselves in harm's way to assist in apprehending somebody.
And the cop, you know, fist bumped me and he was like, hey, so I heard Texans are looking for a new linebacker.
And while she can laugh about it now, Phyllis was in mom mode at the time, saying she just wanted to protect her kids.
I mean, Dub, you saw this tackle. Head up, like, got him right up. She didn't go low. She didn't give him a chance to, like, kind of hurdle her or anything else. She got him. She drove him. You do not want to mess with the Texas mom. I don't know if Phyllis has got football in her background, whether her dad was a football coach or what it was, but she was ready to make a play on this peeping Tom.
Youth coaches, high school coaches, college coaches, even NFL coaches across America need to get this tape. This is how you tackle right here. Head up, neck's not down, crown of the head is not leading. I mean, this is 100% perfect form right here by this Texas mom. She wraps up. She gets the job done. I mean, that was one of the best tackles I've seen all year.
It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, again, the Chiefs did not play stellar defense. I don't think there's anybody out there listening to us right now who's a Chiefs fan that would make that argument. But it was absolutely phenomenal all around. If you haven't seen it, Phyllis Pena making plays.
Be sure to catch live editions of OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We are joined now by Jeff Schwartz, still unpacking a little bit of the Super Bowl, but also curious what he thinks about a lot of the different drama surrounding the quarterback position. But let's start with the Super Bowl. And I want to open with this question, which is one we've kind of been debating off and on all week long on the show, Jeff. You know that basically every NBA conversation ultimately descends to the question of LeBron versus Jordan, right? If anybody sits around and talks about the NBA long enough, that is the never-ending, what I call kind of the black hole of NBA debates that sucks in everything. And as a result, I would argue that it sucks a lot of the joy out of being able to even watch LeBron James from game to game, because every single time anything happens in his career, it's a debate about Jordan. Do you think the NFL is in danger of having its own black hole of conversation where everything surrounding Patrick Mahomes' career becomes related going forward to Tom Brady and who is the best quarterback of all time?
I think after the loss, it won't be that conversation anymore, right? I mean, he's going to have to win many, many Super Bowls. No one's catching Tom Brady. No one's winning 7 or even 8 Super Bowls he wins next year. Like, that's not happening anymore. What he did in New England, he had two separate dynasties. For him to stay and play that long is pretty impressive and, you know, nearly improbable, right? So it's never going to happen again. So I think because Pat Mahomes lost, that conversation is now over. It's now maybe, you know, is Pat going to be – and, you know, Pat could still win 3, 4, maybe the most 3 or 4 Super Bowls. And maybe there's a conversation of, you know, is he, you know, the greatest talent ever to play quarterback? Is he this and that? But I think the idea of now catching Tom Brady is over. If he had beaten him, he'd won 2 now in his first 3 seasons, which would parallel kind of what Tom Brady did, right? He won 2 in his first 3 full seasons starting. You know, then the conversation is on. But they lost that game. It's no longer on. So that did, I think, save us in the football world from the LeBron, Michael Jordan, you know, Tom Brady, Pat Mahomes conversation.
Were you surprised by how dominant the Tampa Bay Buccaneer defensive line was, to the extent that they really got to the point where they didn't even have to consider blitzing? They rushed 4 for most of the game, especially in the second half. Still got a lot of pressure. Mahomes was running for his life. Did that surprise you?
Yes and no. So I think we all thought this would be a problem, right? We watch the ball long enough. We know that when your offensive line is not healthy, you're going to have issues. And we all thought Pat Mahomes would overcome those issues. And I think the offensive line wasn't as bad as people think it was, because there were times when just no one was open. They were all blocked up, but no one was open. So, you know, that's not, again, not on the offensive line. But then as the game got longer and the score got wider and it became very clear they were rushing the passer, then it became a lot worse. And that's what happens in games, right? I mean, the Chiefs tried their best to protect him, protect the offensive line early on. It helped a bunch. They ran the RPOs, the screens. To me, the storyline is 2 in this game. 1, it's the Bucs defense played out of their minds. They played so good. They were so disciplined. They were so focused. They knew exactly what they had to get done. They were great. And the second is the Chiefs offense just, I don't know what they were. They were not what they were in the regular season. Maybe that's because of the Bucs, but the more I watch of it, they were just, their attention to detail wasn't there. Their focus wasn't there. They missed some things they had done really well early in the season. The game plan was it's like they expected Tampa to run the same thing they did the first time. They tried to protect the offensive line almost too much. All these different things just snowballed into that performance. I mean, there's so many different factors, but I think number 1, the Tampa's defense dictated a lot of the problems that Kansas City had in offense.
We're talking to Jeff Schwartz. How do you look at this going forward? Brady at 43 years old throws for 50 touchdown passes, wins the Super Bowl. He doesn't seem close to being done. How many more years do you think he has?
As long as he wants to play. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's 43. He obviously has next year. Look, I didn't think he was done when he was in New England either. I just thought that they just had a bad collection of talent around him. And obviously this TB12 method, this pliability, whatever he wants to call it, definitely works for him. It keeps him, it might make him a lightweight with the drinks we saw 2 days ago. It obviously works for him to be able to play quarterback. And, look, he's very smart. He chose an organization that already had a good offensive line, and they added Tristan Wirfs in the draft. Great, great draft pick for them. He went to a place that had an established defense with a really good defensive coordinator. He went to a place that had weapons, so he didn't have to worry about being stuck with no one to throw to. So he was very smart in choosing where he went, and this situation can prolong his career. If he was somewhere else with a bad offensive line, with no weapons, you know, his career might be done. He might take one too many hits and he's done, but you see, man, he doesn't get hit very often. Like, he is staying in the pocket, standing tall, and obviously still loves the game. And he said after the game, like, I'm coming back next year. It wasn't even a hesitation for him to do so. And I don't know, man, he could play. I think he'll play till he gets hurt, like, whatever that is. If it's next year, like, if he gets hurt, you know, if he, you know, rips up a knee, like, he's 44. He's not coming back from that. So that might be the end. If he just gets hurt, that's it. But he'll play till he gets hurt.
What did you think of the celebration? How awesome was that to see the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on the boats, tossing the Lombardi Trophy back and forth, and Brady also looking like he had a little bit too much to drink?
Well, you know, day drinking on a boat is far worse than...
Well, especially when you're 43 years old and the dad of multiple kids and you don't get out that often.
It's really bad.
But that was before. By the way, before you get to this, we talked about this yesterday on the show. How many alcoholic drinks do you think Tom Brady had from when camp opened until all the way, up to the Super Bowl? Like, how many alcohol? Do you think he had zero alcoholic drinks for that? Basically, like that 7 months, 6 months, or whatever.
I mean,
it is?
Maybe like a glass of red wine after a victory, like at night. Maybe like that's probably it. But that's negligible. That doesn't.
Yeah. Right.
Really,
and it's not really that unhealthy, a red wine, in the grand scheme of things, But so, you think, like, he's so committed to his diet that he did not have any alcohol during the course of the season?
I believe so, yes. And, I mean, we even heard before the Super Bowl that his wife and kids just left town so he could be
alone. For 12 days,
And think about that. His house is like 10,000 square feet.
I know.
He doesn't have to see them if he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just like, removed all distractions from his life.
That's amazing. What do you think your wife would say if you were like, hey, honey, I've got a really big, you know, whatever it is in your life. Do you think you could just take the kids and leave the house for 12 days so I could make sure I do a really good job?
You know what? If I could tell her she'd go to the beach for 12 days, she would go.
She'd disappear, even if she had to take the kids?
Yes. At the beach, the beach is her thing. Like, if you or you anyone else gave us a beach house for 12 days, she would bounce in a heartbeat. Like, that's her thing. Like, yeah, that's the only thing I could get her to do. Is like, hey, we got this beach house. You get to take 12 days off of work too, which is big
for
her.
Right.
And take the kids and go. But the celebration was really good. We had Ryan Jensen, the Buck Center, on my podcast that just dropped this morning, talking about all that too. So I'm excited for you guys to listen to that. Like, it was. It looked like Ryan texting afterwards is like, it got wild. And there's some maybe cuss words in there too. Like, it was, and you know, Brady chucking the Lombardi, by the way, only weighs 7 pounds.
I thought it was a way more, way more heavy than that, but I almost wish that it had gone into the river because I think that would have been so much funnier.
It did. And the only thing I thought of was like, we had those, you know, flotillas. The summer, right? Those parades on the boat. It looked like they were getting the boats were about to like go under. It just didn't look safe for a little bit of time. A lot of boats hanging out there.
If one of the boats, that's a lot of heavy dudes on boats.
It's a lot. It just happened. But I mean, how creative was that though, right? Obviously you're not going to do a big parade, in the middle of a city, during a pandemic. So man, like that was a creative way to go out. And it was funny because I had tried to set up my interview with Ryan Jensen, the center. I texted him on Tuesday and was like, hey, man, do you want to come on Wednesday? He goes, well, I have this boat parade. Maybe I could do afterwards. I go, you're gonna be drinking too much. He's like, that's a good call. And lo and behold, he texted me Wednesday and was like, yeah, I'm glad I didn't come on because it looked like fun. Look, I don't drink very much. If I had won a Super Bowl, I probably would drink a lot. I'd probably smoke a ton of cigars. Like it would not be good. And I think it was good for Brady's image. I'm surprised he let it happen. For everyone to see him drunk, like he looked like a normal human for once. He didn't look like a cyborg. He looked like a normal human that had a little bit too much fun in a celebration.
Yeah, that's what I said, is that social media sometimes can certainly, as you well know, create all sorts of pratfalls. It can create a mess for a lot of different people. But for Brady, I think in the last several years, it's made him so much more popular than he would be without social media. Because whether it was fair or not, he kind of got defined as the uptight version of a NFL player, and Peyton Manning was like the everyman, right? In the way that people thought about Brady versus Manning in their rivalry while they were playing. And so in the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years, Brady has kind of not been it. Because, you know, Brady never said anything in the press conferences. He didn't have funny commercials. He didn't really ever have anything that made him seem like a normal human. And I think whoever has been running his social media over the past several years has just done incredibly well to make him more accessible. When, let's be honest, the dude's been to 10 Super Bowls, won 7. He married one of the most attractive women in the history of the world. He's a good-looking dude himself. He doesn't seem to age. Like, he's not like most people, but social media has made him seem like he's more like people, which is why I think people enjoyed the Brady kind of wobbly a little bit there during the celebration.
His social team is great. I mean, the videos they put out, like everything that he's able to, it's great. They do a great job of it. And you're right. Like, he seems more like an everyday man, which clearly he's not. But I also like how he doesn't pretend that he's not wealthy. Like, the Aston Martin, the Uggs, like, that he does things that wealthy people do. I think sometimes athletes and celebrities like pretend they don't have money, and I think that's disingenuous. Like, everyone knows your contract. Everyone knows you have money. You don't have to pretend like you don't have it. Tom doesn't, which I actually like about him.
Yeah, it's interesting. So going forward, do you think the Bucs should be the favorite in the NFC next year? I know we still got a lot of different moving parts, but based on looking at things right now, my argument would be, to the extent that Brady and that offense got hot and won 8 games in a row down the stretch, you would know better than me by far, but they're only going to be better next year. Again, health always factors in with any team, but when he gets all those reps with Mike Evans and Chris Godwin and Scotty Miller and all these other different guys who theoretically are going to be back there, they should be a lot better on the offensive side of the ball, I would think.
Yeah, so I was going to – even like – when the playoffs started, I was beginning to think about next year. And my thing about next year was, like, the Bucs are my favorite just because, they were supposed to struggle this year a little bit, right? Which they did. Because it takes some time for the offense to get going when you have all these new parts. So this made a ton of sense they would struggle a little bit. So for them to be able to accelerate this quickly in the playoffs, you got to think next year – they're going to be even better. And look, we're going to have veterans next year. Just like mid-tier veterans that are like, depth guys. They're like, can I come to Tampa? Can I come to Tampa? I mean, you're going to have maybe, better depth, better special teams, like little incremental increases. You might get a sixth offensive lineman who wants to come, who would go somewhere else, but wants to be along for the ride. And someone gets hurt, and boom, you have a replacement for someone, right? Like little things like that.
We already saw that a little bit, right? With Antonio Brown, Gronk, and Fournette, among others. All three of those guys, I think, ended up in Tampa because of Brady.
Yeah, and you're going to find this year probably, especially with the salary cap going down a little bit, veterans just, would you rather take less to go play in Tampa or take less to go play in Detroit, right? Probably Tampa. So I think like that's going to be a spot where people go. And obviously now, it's hard to repeat. We've seen no one do it since 2003 and 2004 with New England. So, it's a lot of fun to win a championship, right? You think you could do it again without maybe as much work. And it's up to Tampa now. And Brady, I think, pushes this team to do this to be able to continue to play at a high level heading into next season.
Are we underrating what Tom Brady is accomplishing? I talked about earlier this week. On some level, I think we tend to underrate excellence that's happening in the moment. And then in retrospect, we look back and we're like, man, that was pretty incredible. Or do you think we're fairly evaluating what Tom Brady is doing right now? Because the analogy I made was, this is probably the 10 Super Bowls. This is probably something that no matter how old you are right now listening to us, we will never, ever see anybody do in our lives. That includes, the 15 and 16-year-old kids out there. Like, the odds of somebody going to 10 Super Bowls and winning 7, even if you're going to be a sports fan for the next 60 or 70 years, really low.
Yeah, we're not going to see this again. It is hard to appreciate it in the moment. I think a lot of people like to hate on greatness, right? They like to, Tom Brady's lucky, this and that. Guys, he's won 70% of the 10 Super Bowls he's been in. Like, there's no luck involved with that. Like, you can even say the other way. He should have won two or three of the other ones, right? Now, obviously, you can make the case he should have lost to Seattle when I get that. But, like, he's earned these seven Super Bowls, and people would rather spend time hating on him than giving him the props that he deserves. Just, you know, same as, like, LeBron, right? And I think people focus too much on the losses. You know, Joe Montana was 4-0 in Super Bowls. Yeah, but Tom Brady went to 10. He went to double, 2.5 times, made Super Bowls. Like, so you're going to lose some. Like, LeBron's going to lose some finals. It happened. But I think what's impressive about this, obviously, is, and a couple of them too, right, is he did his underdog. The Rams, he was a, 10-point underdog, his first one. Yeah. And obviously, he lost as a big favorite against the Giants. But you know, he's won kind of in all different ways. And I hope we appreciate him. But we do have, you know, I think for the NFL, it's pretty fortunate to have a Pat Mahomes, right, a guy that can kind of take over the marketing mantle and be the face of the NFL when Tom Brady eventually does leave.
You know, it's interesting when you look at all these different moving parts in the NFL. I think one of the biggest legacies of Brady may end up being the quarterback empowerment era, in particular because he leaves New England and immediately wins in Tampa. So if you are Russell Wilson, Dak Prescott, Deshaun Watson, Carson Wentz, even Matthew Stafford or anybody else, you can look around and say, see, I'm the reason that we can win, and I need to find the right situation to be able to win. It basically creates, to me, a caste system almost in the locker room, which may exist already, but I think it's becoming more clear and transparent. The quarterback is on one level, and everybody else on an NFL team, no matter how good you are at your position, is on a different level. Is that gulf going to widen going forward because of what we saw Brady do this year? And how is it going to play out in the locker room? As a guy who worked on the offensive line, how are those power dynamics in the locker room now? And could they become even more substantial where you basically have like the quarterback on the side of the head coach and the owner, like in terms of power, and then everybody else on the team who is still important, but nowhere near on that level?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's Tom Brady who is the one who's driving this. I mean, you know, he was in New England so long, and then he left New England, but he was a free agent. Like, he was free to go.
Right.
I mean, I think we're looking at, like, Deshaun Watson right now and Russell Wilson and, you know, Matt Stafford and Carson Wentz. Now, Stafford did it the right way. He kind of did it quietly. He spent his 12 years, you know, in Detroit. You know, but we're seeing, it's almost like the guys aren't willing to wait, I guess, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, the guys,
I mean,
yeah.
I think it's more like the LeBronification of the NBA. Of the NFL, but the difference, obviously, is LeBron was also a free agent too. Like,
yeah,
you know, these guys are signing these long contracts and being like, oops, I don't want, well, don't sign
like
your
Deshaun
long contract.
Watson literally just signed a long-term contract with the Houston Texans.
Correct. And so and I get the organization's dumpster fire. I'm with him there, but you didn't have to sign that deal. You could have gone in the franchise tag, obviously, plays a big part in this. I'm not sure it's because of Tom Brady. I just think this is the way younger players are now, right? There's more of a player empowerment,
I guess,
in all of sports.
Yeah, it's a good point. I guess what I'm saying about Tom Brady is this year's Super Bowl win, it really has kind of eliminated any doubt about the power of a quarterback. And this is so incredibly rare, right? To have a guy go from one team to another team and immediately win a championship. I think there are a lot of players and also a lot of coaches and teams that think that look at Tampa Bay and say, man, that could be us next season if we do X. And like,
yeah,
I think that's what the Rams
I
did.
Agree.
They're like, we got to go get Matthew Stafford. I think there are other teams looking around at Russell Wilson, Dak Prescott, Carson Wentz, Deshaun Watson saying, hey, could one of those guys be the difference maker for us? And Brady, I mean, I think it's fair to say nobody really anticipated Brady leaving and immediately winning a Super Bowl with Tampa. Because if people had known that was going to happen, then there would have been like 20 teams trying to sign Tom Brady. And really, it seems like there was only a couple that were that interested in him.
You know, I think it actually, for this kind of phenomenon, first started with the Chiefs going to get Pat Mahomes. Because remember, the Chiefs, and I was on these teams, like the Chiefs were making the playoffs every year with Alex Smith. Like they were, which what everyone wants, right? Just make the dance every year. And the Chiefs were like, you know what? We're going to move on from Alex Smith. We're going to fire ourselves at Pat Mahomes. And I think that kind of freed up teams, you know, and then we saw Kyler Murray, right? And Josh Rosen. the following year. I think.
And now teams, Dwayne Haskins. Guys aren't both. I guess you could maybe say teams and players are not committed to each other at the quarterback position like we have grown used to over history.
Yeah, I think teams are like, look, man, there's no patience anymore, right? We have 3 or 4 year window, and I think we're seeing too that, like, for the most part, there used to be an idea that you could player develop someone over multiple seasons. And, you know, I guess Josh Allen is an example of how that should work, but really it doesn't happen like that very often. And now that, you know, coaches get 3 years, they're trying to win now. Like, they don't have the ability to just work with a guy for 4, 5, 6 years to get him, you know, to where he's able to play. And I think there's just a rush now to win so quickly that it makes it very difficult to, you know, to just sit back and watch a player develop.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Joined now by Todd Furman, one of my co-hosts on Fox Bet Live. We have had a tumultuous week of television where one of the things that's crazy, I mean, I know this is crazy for everybody out there in the world of sports, but we sometimes don't know whether our show is going to be preempted or not because of athletic-related events, because games can come back on the calendar, they can get canceled. Like yesterday, we thought we were going to get Thursday off for a game, but then it got canceled, so we ended up having to do the show. It's kind of wacky, huh?
Yeah, it's a little bit overrated in terms of trying to figure out your schedule well in advance. Thankfully, we get a little week off, a reprieve from one another beginning after...
What are you doing, by the way?
Yes, Trisha. I'm headed out to the Hawaiian Islands, so I'm anxious.
Have you ever been to Hawaii before?
Have never been to Hawaii. I'm anxiously awaiting a negative COVID test as part of the Hawaii travel protocols. You have to fill out an extensive survey for anybody that wants to go out to the islands, but optimistic we're going to get a little R&R, and we'll see if my tan can compete with the tan you'll inevitably come back from Mexico.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to Mexico, and I'll be back on the show. I'll do the show Monday, which is a holiday, and then we're flying out, hopefully, although there's all sorts of snow in the forecast, and it would make perfect sense for Nashville to just get deluged with snow on the day that I'm supposed to be flying down to Mexico and me not be able to go. It never snows in Nashville, so the one day that I'm scheduled to go away on a vacation, the absolute snowfall, it might happen. Shutting down everything could be in play. So what will you do? So when's the last time you took a vacation?
What's the last trip that
you went on?
The last trip we went on, what is it, 2021, so 2000, probably summer of 2019 will be the last time I took an extensive vacation. Went to Greece for about 10 days during July, but this will be the first time that I'm taking a vacation at any point not during the summer months in probably 7 or 8 years, I would say, given the fact that typically in this business, especially sports betting, that your downtime is right after the All-Star break, so we'll call it like the first week in July, up until early August when you start to come back with preseason football.
Yeah, that's
right. You're still working during that process, but of course, last year, different than any other dynamic. You couldn't go anywhere. You had the confluence of sporting events throughout the summer months, so it's rare for me to take a week off when the NBA, college basketball, and NHL are going in full, but I will tell you one thing. I am relishing the opportunity to watch the Daytona 500 on Sunday at 7 a.m. from a swim-up pool bar in Hawaii. It'll be the perfect anecdote of both worlds. The girlfriend can sleep. I can watch the racing in peace.
So, that's what I was going to ask you. How committed do you think you will be to dialing out and not paying attention to what's going on?
Like,
you're gonna get up. Are you legitimately setting your alarm to wake up in Hawaii and go to the pool and just swim up to the bar at 7 a.m. and start watching the Daytona 500?
Yeah, for NASCAR on Sunday, you bet your bottom dollar that's definitely going to happen. Now, will I get up bright and early every single day there? No, there's no reason to. But that's the hard part, is that I say you want to try and take some time off, you want to relax a little bit and tune out all the distractions. But the reality of it is when you work in this sports business, you really can't. And if I were to take a full week off, not pay attention to any of the sports that are going on, it takes you 2 to 3 weeks to try and play catch up for injuries, for current form, and everything along those lines. I will say, though, with the time differences and all of that, I have minimal intentions of watching games other than maybe the middle of the afternoon if I'm sitting out by the pool, but it will not be a focal point, and I can tell you missing a Red Wings Predators hockey game will not be the end of the world for me next week. I'll somehow find a way to cope.
You know, it's interesting. I'm sure you remember this when you were a kid. Like when my dad would go away, my dad and mom both worked, but when we would go on vacation with them back in the day, like when I was young and when my sister was young, we wouldn't be, it was impossible for him to be reached, right? Like, he would take a 2-week vacation. We would go a lot of time, like what we a lot of times did, we would go to Disney World and we would stay in like a camper there at Fort Wilderness, which is like their campground. And for 2 weeks, he would be unreachable. Not only would he be unreachable, we might call, you know, like my grandparents collect to touch base. Otherwise, like, you know, we didn't have a phone in the camper. There was no way to be reached, and we might send back postcards. It's kind of amazing to me to think about that now. To be utterly unreachable is one of my goals now.
Oh, and I think it's downright impossible to be able to pull that off.
Because you got your phone all the time. People are always going to be able to reach. But a part of me would like to be, and I think there's going to be more and more of this on vacations in years ahead, like in a post-COVID landscape. I think a lot of people are just going to say, screw it. I don't want to be in touch, right? Like, I don't want to be reached. I'm turning my phone off for 2 weeks. You know, they have that thing where you can set it up so your email forwards or whatever else. But I think there's a lot of people who would kind of envy that kind of escape, right? Where you can actually escape from the world for a little bit.
Well, I think that's a big challenge. And of course, I have the luxury of not having to worry about kids at home or anything along those lines. So if I leave my phone and we go out hiking for a day in Hawaii, it's not the end of the world. Everything isn't going to fall apart around me if I'm unreachable for 6 or 7 hours. But for example, I imagine if you and the wife go on a trip and you don't take the three boys with you, the idea of leaving both cell phones completely behind and being off the grid for a couple hours is something a lot tougher for parents to try and go through unless they have the entire immediate family with them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. But from a work perspective, I mean, usually the kids, I mean, are going to be at school all day, and ideally they're going to be fine there. But it is an interesting point. Like, are you, when you're in Hawaii, are you guys scheduling aggressively, or is it primarily sit by the pool?
It is a balancing act, because somehow in my world, I have found the only way to date an Italian who can't sit in the sun and actually get color without turning into a cherry tomato. So we ultimately have to try and find a spot that I can sit and get some color. She's able to sit in the shade, and we'll find a balancing act. We'll do a couple days by the pool. We'll do some exploring since neither of us have been to Hawaii. We've been told that one of the things that you want to try and take advantage of is Volcanoes National Park. So that'll be a stop along the way. And just trying to figure out, you know, a perfect balancing act where you're not go, go, go in a scripted itinerary from start to finish, that you get a little bit of rest, relaxation, but you can also see the sights at the same time.
Are you going to more than one place? I've never been to Hawaii. I would like to go. We actually have a lot of listeners in Hawaii. So, by the way, you can let Furman know if you have suggestions on things he should check out at Todd Furman if you're in Hawaii right now. Where are you going in Hawaii?
Oh, I'm definitely open for anybody that has restaurant recommendations or spots that are can't miss. So we originally wanted to do Kauai, but that ultimately had to get scrapped because of some stricter COVID protocols there than other islands. So we're flying into Oahu. We'll do the big island of Kona for about 36 hours, maybe play a round of golf. Par 3 is about the extent of what I'm capable of doing. And then see the Volcanoes National Park, and then we'll spend 5 to 6 days in Maui. And our lovely co-host on Fox Bet Live recommended a couple spots in Wailea that they said strongly encourage us to go to. And I think we're staying in a beach town called Kanapali, or I'm butchering Kanapali. I know I'm butchering it somewhere along the way, but Maui will be the main home base for us for the better part of 5 or 6 days.
All right. So anybody out there who is familiar with Hawaii, lives there, and wants to give Furman suggestions, at Todd Furman, you can hop on there and give him suggestions on places he should see. All right. So let's go in. You mentioned the Daytona 500. Biggest event that is going on in the world of sports this weekend. You love NASCAR. How would you suggest that people bet on it if they are interested in gambling, and or if they're not, what should they expect to see if they're putting it on this weekend?
Well, for this particular race, this one is much better to enjoy as a spectator than it is to find true wagering value, because Daytona and Talladega are called super speedway. So what will happen here is these tracks will have air restrictor plates put on the engines. So it basically provides a level playing field. So whether you're one of the best drivers in the sport or you drive for one of the underfunded teams, it more or less puts everybody on the same plane. So as a result, you're going to see some of the biggest names in the sport, specifically the guys like Denny Hamlin, Chase Elliott, Kevin Harvick, all with odds that otherwise wouldn't be available. And Hamlin has really had a lot of success here at Daytona over the last 5 years. And this is about the shortest price you're going to see with him in that 8-to-9-to-1 range at FanDuel. But again, this is a race known for its wrecks more than anything else. And it's always incredible when you talk about a field that's expected to have 41 cars start. The over-under for amount of drivers to actually finish on the lead lap is set at 17.5. And so when you try and identify how this race is going to go, it's going to be a true wreck fest. So for people that are new to betting NASCAR, bet lightly, maybe bet a couple of guys here to round out the portfolio, but don't adhere to some of the bigger names in sports. Despite Denny's recent dominance, he could just as easily wreck at the midway point as he could grab the checkered flag this weekend at Daytona.
Now that football is over, how do you play college basketball and or NBA going forward with February basketball?
Well, I mean, technically, college football is not over. We have
I know we got. I should point out, yes.
I figured you'd be glued to your TV at 6 o'clock Central for McNeese against Tarleton State. If you could name any players on those rosters right now, I'd be thoroughly impressed. But college basketball during the month of February is typically a time of year where you're going to look at situations more than anything else. And what I mean there is a lot of these teams have already played each other, so you have data points. You've had scenarios with revenge that you can factor into the equation. And focus and motivation. Do teams that find themselves on the outside looking in, not only the NCAA tournament, but with conference tournaments very much up in the air, just kind of go through the motions down the stretch. It's the kind of scenario that we'll see typically in November for college football. You get up for your rival, but you may not bring your A game night in and night out. And I think you have to be extremely selective this year with the COVID circumstances, even more so than you normally are during the month of February. But I typically like February college hoops from a wagering perspective because it provides some of the situational analysis that's not available during November and December.
Let's kind of look big picture in the NFL. A lot of people also interested in looking at who's favored, the odds of which teams are most likely to win championships. Is there any value in betting this far out on the NFL, or with free agency in the draft throwing so many different monkey wrenches in particular, it seems teams are more likely to gamble now. Are you better off just sitting back and waiting in your mind until July and August when training camp season starts?
Well, I mean, you guys mocked me all week long. This time last year, I was making a case for the Tampa Bay Bucks to be a dark horse Super Bowl contender. Now, full disclosure there was because I was fully on board the Jameis Winston train.
That's right. You thought Jameis Winston as MVP made sense.
Hey, I said that they were a quarterback taking the next step away from winning a title. And so technically, I was kind of correct, but Tom Brady obviously helped them over the hump. So at 60-1, it would have been a nice payday along those lines. But when you're looking at NFL futures, what I think is fascinating that over the last 14 years, you've seen the preseason Super Bowl favorite get to the Super Bowl 8 out of those 14 years, but only win it twice. So when you're looking at the numbers with Kansas City a rightful favorite, you wonder about the Super Bowl hangover. Mahomes has surgically operated on foot. I imagine he'll come back 100% with a chip on his shoulder. But who knows how that organization could handle a little bit of the turmoil that's inevitably going to come out from the whole Britt Reid situation or anything else this summer. So I'd be looking further down the board. This is the kind of time of year where you may get a team in that 40 or 50-to-1 range that you think can surprise. And as ridiculous as it is to say, the only team that I would gravitate towards making a very small investment this far out on would actually be the Minnesota Vikings. And the reason I say that, yes, Kirk Cousins isn't truly elite at the position, but you have Dalvin Cook, you have Justin Jefferson, we'll figure out the Adam Thielen situation. So you have nice skill position talent offensively, and on the defensive side, they had an extremely young secondary last year, one that also dealt with a laundry list of injuries. They were without one of the truly elite pass rushers in the NFL in Danielle Hunter. So for me, in the NFC being as wide open as it is, of course the Vikings still have to go through the Packers, that's a team at 50-to-1 that I think showed some flashes and the potential to maybe be that Cinderella story and make a deep run in the playoffs next year.
With pitchers and catchers reporting soon in Major League Baseball, and the appearance being that they're going to play a 162-game season, which would be, I think, pretty great for a lot of baseball fans out there, are the Dodgers a more prohibitive favorite to you this year, given the addition of Trevor Bauer, given the fact that they were already a pretty substantial favorite last year? That pitching lineup that they have now is really pretty phenomenal. Or do you think there's value elsewhere in Major League Baseball?
I wouldn't want to tie up my money in a Dodgers ticket at 3.5 to 1. If you shop around, there are some 4, but at the same time, so many things can go wrong. You mentioned the Trevor Bauer signing, and this, the rich get richer, as the Dodgers right now are going through spending sprees, much like we grew accustomed to with the Yankees when they were in their heyday. But when you look at the dynamic in the National League and try and figure out other teams that could knock them off their perch, you can't ignore the San Diego Padres and everything they've done to bolster their roster. You bring in a guy like Blake Snell, who's inevitably going to help their rotation. A lot of offense there, and Fernando Tatis has all the makings of being a household name and a bona fide superstar in a non-traditional market. We'll see what the Mets elect to do, not only some of the stuff that they've done bringing Francisco Lindor early on, but how aggressive they would be at the trade deadline. You know, their price at 10-1. So I think baseball does offer some intrigue. For me, when I look at the American League, other than the Yankees, who I don't think offer any value at 5-1, there's going to be a team that comes from off the pace. Right now, before I fully do some of my digging, if you can find a team not named the Yankees or White Sox, you're going to find some pretty advantageous numbers to take advantage of.
There was a story that went viral that you basically shot down, which was the idea that the guy who ran on the field as the streaker, although he was clothed, that he was attempting, he claimed that he was attempting to cash in on the bet by getting down money on it. And then the logic of how he got down the money on it did not in any way add up. It didn't stop the story from going viral. Explain why what he alleged was not possible to have happened as he alleged it to have occurred.
It's amazing right now, and I think a lot of people, especially in the gambling space, as it's grown in popularity, would rather publish stories and provide shock journalism, things that are going to get them clicks, more so than doing some of their due diligence. And there's a variety of outlets that circulated this story. So to kind of debunk it, when you talk about someone claiming that they put down enough money to make $375,000 on a prop bet that will there be a streaker in the Super Bowl, paying at 7.5-1, sounds great in theory, because it takes one individual to think outside the box and go out there and stack the deck in his favor. But in the story that TMZ reported, the individual said he sent one of his buddies to Vegas, wouldn't disclose the casino. Well, first and foremost, you can't bet those props out here in the desert for just that reason. Anything that can be impacted by one individual is off the board. It has to have an element of chance to it, and it's part of the reason that the Gaming Control Board out here in the desert still doesn't allow you to bet on who will be the next manager, who will be the next head coach, although other states around the country have gravitated towards those. Along the same lines, he talked about getting down money at offshores with all of his friends. Most of those novelty bets, you can get down $100 to win $750, maybe $200 if you're a known player. So if you run the math real fast and you try and figure that out, there's no way a sports book, offshore or otherwise, is going to incur over $300,000 of liability before it starts to raise red flags. Then he must have, Clay, the most trustworthy group of friends and family I've ever met, that all the people he knows are going to get down for him and then send him a check. You and I have friends. There's no way if we give them that information, they're going to share the wealth with us and just cut us a check for the full amount. So it's one of those things that sounds great in theory and I know has gained a lot of traction, but in reality, until I see actual betting receipts or quotes from sportsbook operators, I'll continue to debunk this. And I just think it provides a little bit of a black eye for the entire industry, because we're focusing on some of the more salacious elements than what actually transpires in the space.
Did you see the story? I don't know if I raised it with you, but I know we texted about it. Morgan Stanley saying that they're going to expect 12 more states to legalize sports gambling this year. We just had Virginia, Michigan, and Tennessee all come online in the last 3 months or so. Other states are planning as well. There's an amazing amount of momentum right now to allow sports gambling to become legal in many parts of the country. Does it amaze you how quickly all of this seems to have coalesced and come together?
I'm stunned, honestly. We knew that there was going to be momentum, and ultimately it was going to be a snowball rolling down the hill. I just wasn't quite sure how fast it was going to happen. Now, the one thing I see for a lot of these states is they believe it becomes the panacea for all of their budget shortfalls. That's one thing that's a little bit problematic, because as we know, when you look at some of the numbers, historical hold on sports betting, let's call it 5%. It's a little bit higher once you factor in parlays and some of the higher hold options. So these states that automatically believe if they open the floodgates athletes for sports betting, that somehow it is going to provide this wealth of riches that nothing else can. They need to pump the brakes a little bit, do some homework, and make sure they provide a competitive model. And it's one area where I've been extremely complimentary of the state of Tennessee, basically going, hey, look, we're going to let every operator come in. You pay your licensing fee. As long as you check the boxes and have all of the elements that you need to provide that good customer experience, we're going to let everybody get involved. I think when you look at other states, whether it's California or New York, there's other political elements that are going to provide obstacles for them offering the same type of competition that's made Tennessee such a success in its first 2+ months.
Yeah, it's interesting because Tennessee benefited because there were no other than lottery, like there's no existing casinos and so or tribal casinos or anything like that. So there was no requirement that the existing gambling industry be taken care of. It's just a brand new industry. And so they could say, hey, it's online only. You pull out your phone as soon as you're in the state borders, you're able to make bets. That's wildly popular. It's really the way it should exist everywhere. But as you just said, there's a political calculus involved where some groups, whether it's tribal casinos, whether it's physical casinos like in Mississippi and Biloxi and down in and up in Tunica, that are relying and allowing sports gambling inside traditional casinos. But that's not how most people are going to bet.
Exactly. And I think in this day and age, unless you can provide a mobile component, then having sports betting is great in theory. But the reality of it is you need to try and give people every vehicle possible to try and get there, whether it's remote signups or a variety of other ways to get them involved. And you talk about it. And I think that's where California is going to run into some obstacles, trying to figure out how to balance the casino interests along with the tribes. And then if New York gets its way and hopefully, Mayor Cuomo comes to his senses that it's not going to be a state-run monopoly, because we've seen how things have transpired in Oregon and Washington, D.C., just to name a few. There's no competitive balance whatsoever, and that will never provide an incentive for people to take their money away from the corner bookmaker where they can play on credit or the offshore market where they're getting competitive prices and bringing it into the legal market. So I think when you look at how FanDuel has done things in the Flutter Group in general, you have to be expansive, you have to be creative, and you have to provide a competitive product that is going to incentivize players, especially in markets where available, to take full advantage of what the legal space offers you from a peace of mind compared to some of the other avenues.
Good stuff as always, Todd Furman. Have fun in Hawaii. Again, give him your recommendations. If you're from Hawaii, you're listening to us right now at Todd Furman. This is OutKick, my man. I appreciate it. Have fun.
Always a pleasure.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.